do. Not to flee Bellingham, the boneyard of my major relationships, but to go toward nourishment, whatever and wherever that might lead. What I would take with me? A memory. About 3 hours into the session, this image began repeating itself. Me, flat on my back, being pulled up to the sky, getting to the top and trying to open my chest, to offer myself up to that sky. But right at the moment I should open, I would recoil in fear and tumble back down, only to try to rise up and try again. Each time at that apex, I would feel this desire to splay myself open, and then this automatic, terrified recoiling. The best gift I could give myself, or any of them, Tim, Laird, even my mother, would be to stop the recoiling, to rise up out of myself, to open my chest and take flight. Constellation. Start close in. Don't take the second step or the third. Start with the first thing, close in. The step you don't want to take. David White. Chapter 79. Classical Homeopathy. Purpose. With more than 5,000 remedies in 3 classes, animal, vegetable, and mineral, homeopathic medicine seeks to enhance physical, mental, and emotional health by gently strengthening our innate ability to heal. Founded on the principle, like cures like, the goal is to increase a patient's immunity in the least invasive, most rapid, and most permanent manner possible. Unlike most medicine, which tries to counteract a condition, the remedies work on the opposite principle. Duration. About an hour. Taking the remedy takes moments, then you wait for the effect. Equipment needed. A heck of a lot of training by the homeopath, and the remedy, in a tincture or infused in little sugary pellets under the tongue, are key. Age, 37. Relationship status. Post-ayahuasca, anti-stage 5 clinger, wannabe. Homeopath. Krista Heron, ND. Remedy. Dog milk. Cost, $90. Location, Ravenna, Seattle, Washington. Like treats like. Samuel Hahnemann. I had gone to Krista years ago with success. She was worth the drive. I thought the recent insights with the UDV might help her strengthen my constitution further. I hoped a subtle remedy boost, the less they are given, the more powerful, so it's not something to overdo, could help me continue to change things up in a positive manner. While my previous remedy had been the riparian parsley-like plant conium, Krista has now decided to give me dog milk. She only shares the remedy name weeks after I feel its effect. Milk, Krista explains, is about nourishment. And the personality of the dog milk remedy, in particular, is for the individual who may feel shame associated with needing that nourishment. Picture a cat. You can't shame a cat for being hungry, for anything really, but you can shame a dog. Think about it. I look down at Isabel, who had snoozed through that appointment between Krista and me. I think of my mother's favorite expression of her father's growing up, sucking a dry tit. Now I find myself ingesting the tiniest amounts of milk, milk from some kind of dog. Nearly imperceptible doses are considered more powerful than more concentrated ones. If like treats like, apparently that's my kindred spirit, a dog in need of more nourishment, but ashamed to need. Krista's notes on dog milk. 1. The milk remedies struggle to cut the umbilical cord with their mother or with their family as a whole, learning to individuate. 2. To prescribe lac canninum, you must have someone who tries to behave as you would like, not how they would like. 3. Lac canninum struggles to express anger freely. They'd like to be furious with rage. I would like to bite these people, but they never do. 4. There is a part they want to vomit or wash out, something they cannot integrate. They feel a sense of disgust and self-loathing. 5. Often, The experience of a loss of an important relationship can be the starting point of their decompensation, losing something they longed for before they could manifest the relationship. They have based their life on trying to secure a love relationship, so when they lose it, they do not want to admit the ways they did not like their primary love, or their mother or father, or admit that now they can be free. 6. The isolation of Lac Cananum is very peculiar. They present as if they are isolated, but often find themselves in the center of things. 7. Some confusion in them and their family exists about the needs of the parents versus the needs of the child. These projections can prevent the mother or father from truly seeing the child's needs, desires, and individuality. 8. They struggle to know what they want. They are floating, feel inconsistent. If a child's own needs are not validated, how can they know who they are or their own desire? This lack of acknowledgement turns into anger, directed inward to become self-loathing. They suppress their anger and hide their aggression. Thousands of remedies, not just dog milk, exist in homeopathy. Each client has a unique manifestation of a pattern. And two people helped by dog milk won't look alike, in the same way one orchid is distinct from the next. Without knowing any of this at the time, drinking dog milk helped me gain momentum to feel myself not as a failed daughter or failed wife, but to look for a full rather than a dry tit. Within hours and through the subsequent weeks, I felt like a big ship with a decided course, cutting through strong seas with a powerful wake. I packed my car and headed out toward fullness. Chapter 80, Cadaver Lab, Yoga Teacher Training. Purpose: to come face to face, body to body, with impermanence. This is acupuncture continuing education, as well as part of Richard Freeman's yoga teacher certification. Cadavers, you say? And yoga? Yes. Richard takes the body quite seriously, dead and alive. Duration: month-long training. Before I started treating breakups as my cardio, I loved yoga. I want to remember that. Equipment needed: a lab containing the requisite cadavers. To donate your body requires much more paperwork than your standard organ donation. Somehow, this helps me. Relative to other options, namely living, these donors wanted to be here. Age, 37. Relationship status, single. Not looking. I'm quieter in this training than normal. Employment, acupuncturist. Cost, $100. Location, Boulder, Colorado. Fresh start. Richard Freeman is what I would describe as the most intellectual, contemplative combination of yoga philosophers with the most advanced of asana practices. Not only can he recite and interpret the Bhagavad Gita with utter splendor, but he can do so, if required, which he never is, while wrapping his leg around his head 15 times. And perhaps it's because he can wrap his leg around his head 15 times that he knows it's not about that at all. It's about a deeper practice, a constant return to the breath. And today's instruction has us not in the studio breathing deeply, but instead in this cadaver lab, trying not to. There's a bit of a smell. With lavender essential oil smeared under my nose as some pathetic attempt to lessen the formaldehyde odor, impossible, the bodies are more still, more empty, more fleshy than I imagined. I find myself holding somebody's entire large intestine in my hands. It's hard to keep it all from spilling out of my palms. While I handle the organs with respect, they are awkward and inelegant. As we pass the rubbery, thick digestive tract around, we then peer into the stomach, and then are handed one lobe of the lung. It is heavier than I imagined, and smaller, like a thick, stiff, fully absorbed sponge. I look at these bodies and think of my father, about how he doesn't believe in death. To him, death is that misunderstanding and mere concept, that idea driven into me to somehow not take myself or difficulty or even something as obvious as physical form more seriously. But these bodies don't look like misunderstandings. It's very clear. Death has passed through these forms, and they are now empty. We isolate an ovarian cyst. On the next cadaver, one student fails to recognize a particular appendage as a penis. We're all kind of embarrassed for him. I'm just thankful I'm not the one who made the gaffe. We peel back the layers of the perineum, the pelvic floor, a multi-story trampoline structure of thick, fibrous muscles. There are at least three levels to peel away. Maybe the midwife was right. Maybe there are four layers of the labia. The cadaverist unpacks the brain and hands some of it to me. I remove the pituitary from the midbrain held between two bones. It looks like a little cave right behind the nose, an impressively small sucker of a gland no bigger than a shriveled pea. As the master gland, it governs all hormones. This speck of a speck is responsible for every bad mood we ever have, each bout of PMS and breast tenderness and bloat, our reproduction, our emotional life, our metabolism. All that run by this here pea. It boggles the mind, that brain that I will be lucky to use for another 70 years, tops. I'm curious to see the plaque tangles associated with Alzheimer's brains. The cadaverist can't find any. I think of those tangles and then of the little memory quizzes my mother has started to give herself secretly and record in her diary. How many names and whose she couldn't remember. How long it took to recall the name. All recorded in minutes and hours. The failed hunts for names of objects she couldn't conjure. No friend or spouse to tell these secrets. Just this beautiful leather book with her increasingly shaky writing within. I don't have the stomach to snoop through the diary again, all because of some tangles I can't see. I ask the cadaverist if he can show us where in the body the sensation of butterflies emanates. I meant this as a purely technical question. He points to the tissue above the diaphragm, the spot he believes responsible for every case of nervous stomach and jitters we've had. Frankly, the responsible area really isn't all that near the stomach. I touch my belly and think of every love butterfly or sinking piece of information that came from that spot. I wish I could drag Dad in here, but I would literally have to drag him, having knocked him unconscious first. This room and its educational mission goes against everything he believes. Here, a physical endpoint is understood. That last station stop for that train, that final eddy in the river before you are washed out to sea. The irony? Mom would have loved to see all this, but now no longer would understand these bodies. Dad would understand it, but refuse to see. Renee would likely be gagging under a gurney with an eye mask she quilted herself and with sharpshooter earplugs stuffed in her nose. And here I stand, the genetic crossing of both those parents who made a woman with particularly dense breast tissue, an anxious mind, at times a goiter-like neck, other times an aggressively thin frame, and so far no known tangles in my brain. Well, not of plaque. Chapter 81, Advanced Hakomi Meets Neuroscience. Purpose. Maji now lives in Canada, so he's referring me to Phil, Maji's teacher, a nationally recognized Hakomi psychotherapist and trainer. Phil says his role with clients is to be an ally to their unfolding. I like that. Duration, once a week, 1 hour and 10 minutes. Phil is generous with the clock. Equipment needed. A highly trained professional. Age, 37. Relationship status. It's obvious, right? Sola, single, alone, solitudinal, independiente. Employment. I've been busy trying new things in addition to acupuncture. Been writing short stories. With all this, I need more passive income. Getting into Airbnb and renting out my Bellingham house and where I live in Boulder. People seem to like how I design things. Cost, $100 a session. Location, Boulder, Colorado. Phil's big, warm eyes look at me. He keeps asking me the same question. What's it like between you and you? This is the strangest question. I much prefer to analyze what it's like between two other people or anybody else and me. Mom and Dad arguing over what love really means and my offering up trite toilet book aphorisms, avoiding conversations about spirituality with my well-meaning stepmother. Why my very presence in any room seems to drive Renee to the other side of it. Why my wanting alone time occasionally with Dad is still considered heresy, and that adult post-divorce trip to SeaWorld doesn't count. What I tried to analyze about any man I'd ever been with and how I could be different so we could share in XYZ. Even with girlfriends, I'm not one of those types to give the "I need to ask you for what I need" speech. I had these fantasies that if I were articulate, insightful, or funny enough, or likable, or accomplished enough, I could pull my father out of his next project or his highest sense of right. If I were clever enough, I could decipher my mother's disappearing language and pull her out of her sadness. If I were non-threatening enough, I could get my sister to want to spend time with me. If I were yogic enough, I could get Laird to be different. If I were tough love enough, I could have gotten Tim the help he needed earlier. If. But when Phil asks, "What's it like between you and you?" I go blank. Literally blank. I didn't even know where in my brain to go look. When I feel this blankness, I know I must turn toward it. So I do. It is awkward and uncomfortable, but Phil insists I find those answers for myself and encourages me to experiment. These final experiments are of my own making. Not from anybody else, just me. Chapter 82. Accidentally write and perform a one-woman show. Purpose. Try to find a narrative arc in your life that, even if it makes you look like the biggest clunk schlub in the world, still might help a stranger have a laugh and get through their own challenges a bit faster and more gently. Duration, 80 minutes, about. Equipment needed, simple props. My stage looks like an acupuncture treatment room / therapy office. What a surprise. Age, 37. Relationship status. Special to have family and friends come, quite the reunion. My Aunt Donnie and her kids came, and my kind step-sibs. Coco wore a name tag that said Renee. Coco hoped she'd show. So did I. Cost. You won't believe how cheap it is to rent a little theater in Boulder, Colorado. Humiliation factor. Some excellent risk factors. A room full of strangers, a lot of words, and me. Weirdly, I was more nervous to treat my first patient. The good news? Embarrassment isn't dangerous. Location, Boulder, Colorado. Coco and I not only bonded philosophically over acupuncture styles, we also seemed to have stomached our own losses in parallel. She, her eyes, mine, my marriage, and possibly my SSRI 7-day mind. And two mothers with Alzheimer's. Coco coped with lots of stillness and alone time, listening to audiobooks, trying to distract herself from thinking about what she could no longer see. I coped with dramatic gestures and relational antics. And Coco would say that, like with acupuncture, it was her dogged curiosity that kept her from dumping me as a friend when I was so man-obsessed, kept her trying to understand why somebody, me, would make such polar opposite decisions than she would. Like watching absurd reality TV. On my end, I felt this urge to distract and amuse her by turning the days, weeks, months' antics into stories, the eggs, the sticks, the doula births, the surveillance. So I wrote them down and read them to an audience of one, Coco, hoping to create a counterpoint to her reality, encroaching blindness, from which there was no escape. I'd be lying if I didn't admit that writing was a place to let my freak flag fly. Perhaps the stories helped us both feel rooted, to mark that we were both still here, even as we lost our mothers word by word, helped us see and be seen, not just by others, but each other. The stories became quite a pile. Now that you aren't obsessing over Laird anymore, maybe you should take that energy and do something new. Well, I've been thinking, I say shyly, of stringing them together and speaking them. Like a long version of that moth performance thing I did in Bellingham, mixed with that singing lesson recital in my acupuncture office I did with my singing teacher. You know, like one long story, like a show. I'm embarrassed to use the word show out loud, even to Coco. A show, Coco is thinking, not judging. Kind of like putting on a play with friends when we were little, no? I ask Coco. She then replies with a burst, laughing around her words. You know what you should do? You should go to the Boulder Dairy Theater. They converted an old dairy into performance spaces. You should go rent a theater and do it! A dairy? That sounds amazing, I laugh with delight. I picture cute cows and milk pails and straw, with shows and little horse stalls. My kind of theater. Well, maybe only if you would critique me, and Leah too. As luck and irony would have it, Leah, my Bellingham singing teacher, had moved to Coco's town of Fort Collins. It could be like the fun of putting on an eighth grade play, but as adults, right? And that was exactly what it was like. My grade school friend, actress, and writer, Spencer in New York, helped me string the stories together. And then Leah, Coco, and I would gather in Fort Collins Parks, Coco's living room, and Leah's backyard, and I would memorize and tell the stories. An unknown benefit slash skill of acupuncture school was how many role-playing scenarios we had to do, so we were experienced at critiquing each other and our authenticity as we practiced our patient interviewing skills. I walked into the dairy in May. They had a week open in July. How much is the Black Box Theater? $100. Are you kidding? 100-seat theater? $100 a night? Christ, everyone should host a show. I'm in. I took all the open nights they had. I had 6 weeks to get it together. So, should writing and performing your own show be a calling, here's a high-speed list of the how of it. Write some stuff down that you think matters or, in the very least, you think worth retelling. Have friends help you cut out the useless, poorly written, dullard parts. Memorize your stories while walking your four-legged in circles around your neighborhood, saying your whole show out loud. Find some props from your living room and office, massage table, stability ball, therapy chairs. Practice some more. Laugh really hard at idiotic mistakes. Accelerate toward embarrassment. It makes the whole thing easier. Don't care if you are profound or good at it. Just do it. Get really panicky that you will host a show and not a single person will buy a ticket except maybe your dad and some pervy old man with loud plastic bags in his lap eating a sandwich. Take yourself and your furry Isabel to Boulder County Farmers Market, and while they pet her, she loves strangers of all kinds, pass out flyers while saying, come to a funny show with a funny woman. And when they ask, who is this funny woman? Say, I am the funny woman, and try to keep a straight face at how fool-headed this sounds and not die of humiliation. Be grateful for terror as a continued motivation. Run an ad on Craigslist for a lighting designer. Meet lighting designer, petite Korean woman named Sophia, the night before the show. When your co-director Leah's husband is rushed to the emergency room with nausea and stomach pains during the dress rehearsal, try not to take this personally. Be grateful he turns out okay and that she can still come for the real thing. Try not to worry when your blind friend has to hold a very tall ladder in the dark theater with the pint-sized Sophia teetering at the top, adjusting gel lights. Too bad Isabel lacks opposable thumbs and prefers snoozing on the cool cement floor. Forget that you need to rent sound equipment and watch Coco try to hide behind the curtains to see if holding up a Bose boombox is loud enough. Turns out, it isn't. No matter where Coco thrusts out the speaker from behind the black velvet curtain. Realize you will need to rent sound equipment, which is maybe why the theater is so cheap. Find comfortable shoes and a dress. Be shocked when you oversell your tickets and have to bring in extra chairs. Practice your narrative again. Pray you don't go blank once you hit the stage and see the 100-plus faces in front of you. Practice the small bit in the middle and the end when you sing. Keep going even if you mess up. Never point out your mistakes, even if you've been pointing out your mistakes your whole life to everyone. Be grateful that a friend could fly with your mother so she could see it too. Be aghast your mother asks whether you've had implants. No. Realize that your chosen dress might have been cut too low and try to fix it. Thank Michelle and Scott for the dairy party they throw on the last night. Have it go well enough to take it to a little festival in New York City where you, Coco, Leah, and Sophia enjoy being the most wide-eyed, least trendy people in the festival. Be thankful that you and your friends haven't lost that enthusiasm for putting on plays and telling stories you believe in. A combination of qualities your little troupe shares that comes from the innocence of youth, peppered with a hearty appreciation for finding the good in the hard knocks. Chapter 83. Date Yourself. Purpose. Call it a refresher on the real you. Although I hate that phrase. Like all relationships, the one with oneself merits special attention. Consider the classics. The Friday and Saturday nights, the Sunday brunches. Duration. Unclear. Maybe I'll get lucky tonight. Equipment needed. I recommend full pre-date antics. The shower, the special outfit, the shave, the wax, whatever does it for you. Although, if I get a Brazilian, I'm pre-dating with tequila. Age, 38. Relationship status. Single. Whatever. Cost. Dinner tab. Humiliation factor. Say your best self-loathing things to yourself for, like, 5 minutes, then ditch all that and have fun. Location, Denver and Dolores, Colorado. It's embarrassing, at first, to go on a date with myself, because a cultural assumption exists that because you're solo, you couldn't get anybody better to join. Ridiculous. So I'm taking that one down, killing it. Whether married or single, straight or gay, very few of us get all that much pleasurable downtime with ourselves in the same way we get it with other people. Also, it's kind of like orgasms. Helps to know solo what a good one feels like so you'll recognize who's giving you an excellent one. If I don't know what I'm looking for, well, you see where I'm headed. So I'm backing up the simple date. I had solo and partnered orgasms down fine. The self-enjoyment, not in bed thing, not so much. It had been a very long time since I got any real good social kick out of myself. I started out with a romantic dinner. Okay, a lightly romantic dinner. Okay, not romantic at all. The Cheesecake Factory. What can I say? I happen to love their Caesar, which, by the way, can easily feed a family of 10. Cheap date. I brought a book and a pad of paper to draw. While the book made me feel like a spinster, with the doodling, I felt like a dining rebel. It felt kinder to fancy myself a doodling, self-dating, dining rebel. I ordered my favorite Caesar salad, my favorite margarita, with my favorite tequila. It's not as if I'd never eaten alone in a restaurant before. This was more like going on a date with somebody who, for years, had just been a friend, but we wanted to check out the deeper potential, so we stepped it up. The same motions, the appetizers, the wine, the food, but now very consciously on a date. There's the question of what to talk about with myself, or, for that matter, what else to do. I've always been a fan of eavesdropping. Lucky for me, I have a gift for eavesdropping and doodling simultaneously. I ate, I drank, I joked with the waiter, polished off the marg, and headed home. No goodnight kiss. But I just might call me the next day. I thought she was sort of interesting. After a few more dinner dates, I step up my level of commitment, the weekend getaway. I pick the very special Dutton Hot Springs outside Telluride, Colorado. The place is built for couples, but I'll sort that out. Technically, with Isabel, we're a party of two. The Dutton Bar allegedly served Butch and Sundance their first beers after they robbed their first bank. The fact that a female, drunk, sales executive from San Diego is dancing on the bar to keep her geriatric date interested frankly gives the Butch Sundance thing a run for its money. After full bellies and an endless ball session in the twilight, Isabel could and would have asked, happily retrieved till dawn, "Isabel and I head to our cabin," which is where Bilbo Baggins and Robert Redford would honeymoon should they marry. Original Western log 19th century chinking, but with tiny arched doors to duck through to get to the bathroom. With a hot spring a stone's throw from my cabin, but without someone whose eyes I could gaze into with oogly-googly longing, I didn't want to blow the best activity at the get-go. I also brought my taxes, in case I couldn't gut out the leisure stuff. By morning, after a hike with Isabel, including a few uphill, off-trail sprints to prevent Isabel's out-of-her-mind, I must chase and say hello to those white-tailed deer, I thought the whole dating thing was going pretty well. I mean, I wasn't ready to make any marriage proposals, but I'd do me. At nightfall, I crawled via ladder down into a large, sunken, barrel-like hot spring to take in the night sky. Turns out I wasn't so good at taking in the night sky alone. None of that, "Are you sure that's Orion's belt?" or "Ever seen the Northern Lights?" I knew the answer to both. Yes, that's really Orion's belt. I'm sure of it. And yes, I've seen the Northern Lights. They were greenish and brief. So in lieu of soft talk, I gaze up at the stars and find myself feeling shy and a little awkward to be with myself. I feel young and vulnerable and kind of sweet. Like I can remember the soft part of me that is still very much in need of care. I try to sit through the discomfort of feeling this shy, sweet, what am I really about sort of thing. When I think I can't bear it one more second, I bear it one more second. Turns out this kind softness to myself feels rather delightful. Delightful enough that I start trying to drag the date out. The small valley looks like a miniature old town, with the quaintest dotting of cabins right out of the most idyllic Western. I decide to go for a stroll. Isabel and I walk through the oil torches that illuminate the road like a work of art. Her jangly turquoise collar is the only sound other than our footsteps. I head to the library and nestle into a wingback chair to peruse a German design book while sipping whiskey they leave out. I don't think I'll like whiskey, but it seems like an experience I should have. In lieu of a sexy foot massage, I remove my shoes and rub my feet on my first bearskin rug. Isabel splays on her back there too, offering her belly for a rub and a scratch. I oblige. After a spell, I meander back toward our Bilbo cabin. I stop on the carless dirt road and lie down with my face up to the stars. I think, if I were with someone, I would do this. I will never have this moment back. And so I rest. I rest on my back and breathe in the night sky while scratching Isabel's flank. I count three shooting stars. I stay until I'm too cold to stay any longer. I gather myself, taking my own hand, my own heart, my own self, back to the snugly warm down comforter that Isabel and I will burrow into. If I feel racy, I might do so naked. But only if it's extra toasty in the cabin. I'm definitely going to marry this woman. This weekend, clinched it. Turns out, she's a keeper. At least for me. Chapter 84. The Hoffman Process. Purpose. An intensive residential course of personal discovery and development. The process allows you to examine your life and your behavior and empowers you to make lasting changes while increasing emotional intelligence and spirituality. I'm considering it. Harvard Business School recommends it. Duration, 8 days. Equipment needed. Luggage and baggage with the willingness to unload both. Age, marching toward 40. Relationship status. I am almost never without Isabel at my side. She bounds along wherever we go, but seems to know when we have to use our inside voices, too. I miss Taraco, but with Isabel's mere 35 pounds and sweet nature, even a few places that don't allow dogs let us break some rules. Cost, $4,295. Humiliation factor, we will discuss. Location, St. Helena, California. I'm back in touch with my childhood friend Kimberly's parents, Marilyn and Gary, the ones who did the Est Children's Training road trip with us, who also studied with Lawrence. We've spoken intermittently, as old friends do. They too have a mother with Alzheimer's and, like most people, have complicated family issues in dealing with such things. That's largely what we've been catching up about. The way our mothers look and feel so different. The way I can literally sense the ebbing of her consciousness and the volume of light decreasing in my mother's eyes, to the way her body has less force to animate her being. And did I mention? They want me to do the Hoffman process. I got the big email plug about it. I know an email plug when I see one. I've heard about the Hoffman process. And despite my conditioned practice of acknowledging there's always more we can learn, still one of my mother's favorite sayings, I might add, I would have no problem if she forgot that one. I'm willing to bet my right frontal lobe that I'm sufficiently familiar with the Hoffman terrain. I say this without pride, more like a checklist of sorts, like traveling to Europe. But not just the top hits. I mean the thorough itinerary, beyond the photo in front of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I mean like slog to the top of Mount Blanc, check. Hijack a gondola in Venice, check. Tickle a Vatican guard, check. Lean into Stonehenge, like give it a really good push. Checkity check. I hear Hoffman helps you map out your family of origin in some sort of exhaustive list diorama so your family issues don't grip you as they once did. Check. I hear the idea is to take time out of your life to examine your life and talk about how it was formed. Check, check. I hear you'll explore how to forgive your parents while understanding how you've rejected or adopted their negative traits. Check, check, check. I hear by treading in your own murky waters and getting more clear, the Hofster will help you develop deeper compassion for your fellow humans. I hear you hit things with a big stick or baton, for heaven's sake. Christ, I'll volunteer to teach that one myself. So I'm going to go against my conditioning and kindly decline the Hoffman process. I'm putting my money on the Megan process without needing to recruit anybody to try it too. So God love them. Even if Marilyn and Gary met Allah, Mother Mary, the Buddha himself, or if Kenny Loggins is a huge fan, I ain't doing it. I bet it's fabulous. And you know what? I'm still not doing it. You heard me. And any extra $4,295 that crosses my path, it's going into savings or Alzheimer's research or swimming the Arno or, Christ, a much longer trip to Dutton. It's not that I'll never try anything again. I just know that deferring to my own authority may mean saying a kind no thank you more than in the old days. And while I may not get the same pleasure of thinking of myself as someone who's game for most any experiment, in exchange, I garner the new pleasure of how it feels to trust myself. Although, if they really did meet the Buddha... Chapter 85. Spend time with Maasai school kids. Purpose. I have been invited by the founder of the International Community for the Relief of Suffering and Starvation, ICROSS, a network of primary care clinics across Kenya, to document the work of his clinics and visit corresponding Rift Valley Maasai schools. I'm writing for a new blog. Duration, 14 days. Equipment needed, nothing. Age, 40. Relationship status. I tried taking a lover in Brooklyn on my way to and from Kenya. Met him at Burning Man. Screams cliche. As for the lover part, what a bust. I'm not cut out for the casual deal. Casual kissing? Maybe. Sex is apparently never casual to me. Employment. Still an acupuncturist, but the Airbnb stuff is going remarkably well. Meanwhile, I come to Kenya in a rather official capacity as a freelance writer. Jenny, a professional photographer and friend, joins me. Cost, plane ticket, wasn't cheap. Location, Great Rift Valley and Karen, Kenya. I now stand in front of a room packed with 50 Maasai schoolchildren. I get to interview them in small groups with my shy friend Jenny. I am interested in knowing what they imagine for their lives, what troubles them, what brings them joy. Before we get started, I figure it's only fair they get to ask anything they want of Jenny and me, two white, manless women traveling solo. This is what they want to know in this order. 1. What is the staple of our diet? 2. What do we think of Barack Obama? 3. How do we bury our dead? I try to cover 1 and 2 simultaneously. I make a gross generalization saying much of the country is thrilled about Obama. The ones that are thrilled tend to eat more vegetables. The ones who are less thrilled tend to eat more meat and potatoes. The Maasai children find this confusing, as they, not just as Maasai warriors, but as Kenyans, are thrilled about Obama, but they also mostly eat meat and the occasional potato, as they are a nomadic culture becoming less nomadic by the year. I try to clarify that I've made a bit of a stereotype that's more of a joke. It is thrilling to make these kids laugh, to feel humor crossing linguistic boundaries. They laugh before anything is translated, like we all know the universal rhythm of humor without needing to know every word. As for how we dispose of our dead, I rather simply explain we like to be buried, burned, or thrown into the ocean. Upon hearing my summary, Jenny, who is quite possibly as shy as I am extroverted, feels compelled to speak up. She mumbles to me that I need to clarify that we just don't wing our dead out of boats and into the sea. We burn them first. And we use a nicer word, cremation. As for the burning idea, which seems to horrify the kids, Jenny would like to make sure I also clarify we aren't burning anybody alive. I am to stress we do this ever so respectfully and only after our loved ones have passed. So while I stand here trying to tackle death, politics, and diet in a 1-2 punch, it occurs to me there are about 500 things I'm grateful they aren't asking me about. To that end, I hope they haven't noticed the teensy-weensy, previously not-so-teensy-weensy, droop of my left eyelid. I'm praising some higher power that I don't have to explain. 1. Why I would willingly, a.k.a. enthusiastically, shoot Botox, a.k.a. the botulinum toxin, into my forehead. 2. How is it I became the lucky 1 in 500 bastards to have my botulinum migrate into my left eyelid, rendering me a one-eyed Quasimodo for about 6 sexy weeks? And while I've passed the phase of literally needing to prop up my lid with my index finger in order to make any proper use of my second eyeball, I still might not look quite right. 3. Should they notice my lingering, subtle droop, this would shoot us directly into a far trickier conversation than death and burial. Like, why in the world do we in the United States hide our age? How did it come to be that I don't just shoot up Botox, but sleep in a bra, trying to keep everything north of town, quietly fighting aging like it's a high crime? 4. I'm also thrilled not to have to explain that I, and others, choose to purposely starve myself for up to 21 days a year, all in the name of longevity and anti-cancer research, peppered with a tinge of an eating disorder. I do so all the while surrounded by an endless supply of gorgeously colorful, antioxidant-rich, high-quality food. And even with access to such amazing food, how could I possibly explain to them we still die of nutrient deficiencies and diseases of excess rather than scarcity? But that's like a whole talk or another chapter. 5. Why we feel a need to co-opt other cultures. Like, why we asked a Brazilian shaman, a Buddhist, and a Native American to come bless my acupuncture school, but would never ask the Protestant pastor down the road to bless our former dentist office come Taoist acupuncture school in Louisville, Colorado. 6. While on the subject of ritual, I'm thrilled I don't have to explain my Brooklyn lover attempt at Burning Man. And regarding Burning Man, who wants to explain how you can't tell whether a giant teepee in the middle of the desert filled with sleeping people is an art installation or merely random attendees passed out having lost their way back to their tents? While we're at it, I can also say I'm thrilled to not have to explain therapy involving a bataka bat, talking to pillows, self-administered EMDR, going commando, and my experiments not wearing underpants as a means to find freedom. Nor grocery store therapy assigned by a licensed therapist where I end up with corn dogs, potato salad, and gummy frogs in my basket as an actual exercise. Nor my current musing whether first aid military anti-shock pants can be used for emotional trauma as well as physical trauma, keeping the blood in your core when in shock. I guess you can say that at least we're trying to construct ritual and alternative culture in the face of a dearth of both. I suppose this circles us back to why I'm torn over our documenting these Maasai kids in the first place. We sense they've got something we don't, yet we can't help but visit with some air of superiority. I think I should end this school interview and just give one of these kids Jenny's camera, a notepad, and a plane ticket, and say, "You want a really good laugh? Come see the trouble we Westerners have gotten ourselves into." Chapter 86, Facing Death. Purpose. Meet my mother wherever she is. Phil and I talk about the Sanskrit term darshan a lot. It means to see. That sometimes one needs to just go see. To see things exactly as they are, not need them to be different. Duration, 1 month. Equipment needed. Beyond hideous sweatpants, nothing but the intent to bring all of me. Age, 40. Relationship status, I am alone. Solitude has been my other teacher, and it's not permanent. Employment, acupuncturist, aspiring writer, landlord, Airbnb host. Cost, short notice plane ticket, one phone session with Phil mid-month. Location, Langley, Whidbey Island, Washington. I just got the call. Mom has fallen and broken her hip and neck at her farm. Head hit the safety railing. Her feet slipped out from under her on those river rock steps in front of the house, Renee tells me. I find this ironic. The safety railing. Mom was refilling one of those bird feeders. Mom is single-handedly trying to feed the entire bird population on the small northwest island where she lives. Renee still lives there too, just up the road with Rich and little Kelsey. Mom was at the heart of where Renee wanted to build her own family. Renee and Rich married on the farm in a stunning fall wedding, conceived on a visit, and then Mom got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Wasn't the plan. As for this neck and hip break, post-surgery, she will be weeks in rehab. And then, as it often is with the elderly, there will be trips in and out of the hospital. This and the hospital stay itself will tax her. But this time, my sister's call tells me this could be it. They don't know. Nobody knows. Now I'm on a plane. Now I'm waiting for Isabel via kennel near the luggage carousel. They say Portuguese water dogs have an extra octave that easily identifies them, and it's true. I hear her distinct high bark and her kennel approaching. Now we are in the rental car driving north, both peering through the rainy windshield, wiper blades working overtime. I hate this soupy city and its weather. If I time it right, we can be through downtown catching the next ferry in 45, but I doubt it. Two boats later, we are dumped onto the island, now chugging up the hill through the downpour. It's dark. I wished I'd figured out where I was staying tonight, but there wasn't time. Not with Renee. It's not that I'm uninvited, but I haven't been invited. I drive slowly through the village, looking for that right turn. When I get there, I enter the living room de facto lobby of the care facility. Renee is on the phone with a doctor. She waves, then waves me on. She looks tired. Apparently my mother's room is at the end of the hall. My last thought before entering is, remember, she'll be smaller. She will look different. That's okay. Just go with it. whatever she looks like, join her there. She is a miniature version of herself, and she is throwing up. The care provider is making sure my mother keeps hold of the large Tupperware bowl while saliva drips and hangs thickly from her mouth. Her eyes are watering. Here comes another wretch. Small blurbs of bile seem to be the only thing coming out. I know they haven't been able to keep anything down her in days. I understand the nausea has been unabating. Oh, my little mama, my sweet mama. You finished? Kathy, the care provider, asks. Mom sort of nods and looks over at me. Hi, Mom. It's Megan. I climb onto the bed. I can't really hug her with the neck brace. It's a Lilliputian neck brace, a child's small. But it's still too big for her. I lean in to kiss her cheek. She smells sour. Kathy, the care provider, wants to get in there and change the padding on her brace. This place is spotless. The owner was a Colonel Army nurse, and that fact is obvious as I look around. I curl up next to my mom. She can't look down at me, but I can move my head to get a good look in her eyes. She looks exhausted. I ask how she's feeling. Not good. Not good at all. I don't know about all this business, Megan. I don't know. She never complains, so this means something. I know, Mama. It looks rough. The worst, really. It looks like you're having a go of it. Nobody knows what's causing the nausea, the inability to eat. Is it the pain medication or some sort of infection? The mystery will continue for weeks. I will find a rhythm here, just not an easy one. When I'm not in the room with her, the care providers don't like us here all the time, there are rules, Isabel and I walk in the rain. I make phone calls. Although most of my life is on hold, the emails are backing up, but I don't care. I start reading Winnie the Pooh out loud to her. My own mother's reading cadences come back to me. Maybe I am channeling the memory. I am 6 years old now, stretched out on the giant leopard print beanbag with my mother next to me. Only today, I am the one reading. I will read about Pooh and Piglet going searching for a heffalump. My mother smiles in recognition. She knows the story like the back of her hand. While she couldn't recall it, she can ride the familiarity. And with Alzheimer's, it seems the oldest stories stay the longest. Maybe I'll stick with this one for a few days. Sometimes I crawl onto the bed and ask the questions I know no one is asking. There's this assumption that she should be fighting to live, that she should get herself to eat at any cost, and fight the infection as hard as she can. I'm not sure this is what she wants. I've met the hospice nurse. Nobody knows if she's coming or going. When I am alone with her again, next to her again, I take a breath and ask quietly, Mom, are you ready to go? Are you tired of this, or are you interested in what's next? Do you want to stick around? Do you know? She looks at me with wide open, wet blue eyes, takes a big breath, and looks like she's really mulling the idea of leaving or staying. There's a flash of relief across her face. I imagine it as a fleeting flash of a sense of power or control, like mid-fight it hadn't occurred to her that it really still is all up to her. Maybe she's been so caught up in the fight, there'd been no time to consider this. That's a really good question. I don't like feeling like this anymore. I want it to be done. The idea of finding out what's next sounds nice, but I don't know. I don't know. I'll have to give that some thought. I want her to know that anything is okay. I don't know how to impart that sense of permission or freedom to her, so I talk about eagles. That's her animal, her power animal. She read a book on a plane about shamanism once, flying to Chicago to help a childhood friend of mine in a shamanic ceremony. Mom met her power animal in like 5 minutes after closing her eyes. This woman has the most unusual and unexpected gifts. In my quietest voice, I conjure an eagle in my head and ask gently, "You want to fly around up there?" And I start making those sounds like I'm the wind, or like we're in the wind together. Like an eagle is catching wind under its wings, a faint whistle. She seems to like the sound. She closes her eyes. She makes a little of the sound herself. She's tired. I kiss her goodnight. I find myself touching her soft face and hair more bravely and tenderly than I ever have. And she lets me. The days wear on. More vomiting, more measuring her fluid intake in teaspoons, not cups. Nothing seems to stay down. Between the vomiting, I read to her or she sleeps. Winnie the Pooh again. She laughs sometimes. Other times it is too much. I don't know if the reading makes a difference, but I think it might. I close each night by reading Mary Oliver, Mom's favorite poet. Because of her memory, she won't remember that I read Wild Geese last night, or the night before that, or the night before that. But I have, and I will read this poem again tomorrow. We will read of the geese and their skyward return, of all the landscapes we must move through to reach home. This is her poem, our poem, a poem between us, a poet that links her to me, and it fits here. I am sure it fits here. Wild geese heading home, somewhere through the nausea, through the fatigue. I know this poem is talking to some part of her still here. The thing is, she's not who she was, but at the same time,